Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, all of my wonderful friends out there in the web world, my virtual buddies, who actually, I don't even know if any of you truly exist. How strange is that? Kind of a matrix type of thing. I see your logins. I see the data that shows you're out there, but I have no physical, tangible evidence. How apropos, how much at you know, it's so similar to what we experience here in the study of UFOs. Strange. Is the internet, and I've heard other people talk around this, is the internet some sort of device that gets us used to this sort of non-physical sort of relating to each other, being able to know each other? I have all these Facebook friends, but I've never met them, and some of them I feel pretty close to. Some of you in the chat I feel pretty close to. But how do I know you exist in physical form at all? Is there going to be a time where we are communicating with each other and we do not exist in physical form? Wow, crazy stuff, crazy stuff. So one person in particular that I converse with a lot, I see a lot of his information, I talk to him about him a lot, but I've never met him in person. How do I know he exists other than just some sort of web entity out there? How do I know he is an extraterrestrial himself? And this is a gentleman who is our guest tonight, and I'll have to ask him, and that's Roger Marsh. I talk about him all the time, especially when I do our UFO news, because he is the UFO examiner, national examiner. He goes to the CMS, and he's been doing this for some time, and we'll talk to him about how long he's been doing this, but thank goodness that examiner.com has come around so he can do this at a level where more people are able to see his work. But he takes the reports from the CMS, the MUFON reporting tool, and he puts those in a story format so we're all able to see what's going on, because, like I've been telling you guys, there are tons and tons of reports that pile in to the MUFON database. And I'm talking about hundreds in a month. I'm talking about thousands a year. So there are a lot of sightings. In fact, I can pull up right here the statistical reports for July. In the United States, there were 580 UFOs reported to MUFON. In the UK, 19. In Canada, 16. Mexico, 9. To give you an idea of where we're getting all of these. And that's just because MUFON focuses in the United States. No doubt organizations out there in those other countries do receive more sightings. And if you go state by state, just to give you an idea of the top states, California has had 62 sightings, Pennsylvania 44, Indiana 37, Michigan 35, my home state here, Colorado 31, Florida 30, Texas 27, So we're getting a ton of people reporting UFOs and UFO sightings, and there's no one that I know of that is closer to those daily reports than Roger Marsh. So we will be talking to him about what he does and what he's been seeing over these past year that he's been doing this. I don't even think it's been a year. And about how he's been so successful. He's gotten over 1 million hits on his stories. So this has been great. And if you don't know, some of the other cool stuff Roger Marsh does, he has made a couple movies, and I know at least one of them has been around UFOs. He's written some plays. He's done a lot of other interesting and creative stuff. So this is going to be a lot of fun tonight talking to Roger. So we'll be talking to him in just a minute. And I won't be including his stories as I review the news because we're going to be able to talk to him, and I'm going to hold on to those stories for to ask him about those. So I'll review those recent UFO stories from the Examiner and when we bring him on. But as usual, well, let me plug a couple things first. I got to plug the UFO Paranormal Network. And why do I got to do that? It's because they're syndicating my show, which is awesome. I'm so excited about that. He's decided to choose a somewhat, at least temporary, spot for me after Angela Joyner, which I know is about 10 p.m. Mountain Time. That's the UFO Paranormal Network. And you can go to their website. Just Google that. You'll be able to find them. They're all over the world, and that's what's so exciting about it, because they get listeners from Australia and India and all over the place. I know they're on satellite radio, I think, in Australia. So it's really cool, and I think that a lot of my new Facebook buddies, like I talked about before, are because of those that international attention that my shows have been able to get thanks to the UFO Paranormal Network. So thanks, Joe. There's some other great shows, too. So Karen Dolan is before me, then comes Angela Joyner, and then me. And these people are all awesome. Karen Dolan is Rich Dolan's wife, but she's a very interesting person and has a lot of great people on her show. Angela Joyner was the one who broke the Stephenville case. She was the local reporter from Stephenville, and she's really cool. She's new to this whole field, so when you listen to her show, it's great to have that refreshing, you know, kind of fresh perspective on all of this. She's not a UFO researcher, so a lot of this is new to her. And it's also interesting to see her experiences as she tries to muddle through all this information that can be contradictory and try to figure out what is real and what isn't. And that's what we're all trying to figure out, right? So let's look at some of the other news going on. Some real interesting news that I've posted. I don't know if I don't think I mentioned this because it says I posted it on the 26th and my last show was on the 25th of July. However, this was great. This was Buzz Aldrin, who has been interviewed lately, and he's been really hyping up the need to go to the moon. He's getting people excited. You know, we need to go to the moon. That's where our next base needs to be. And there were a lot of scientists. In fact, just a few years ago, when George Bush, you may remember this, started talking about we need to go to the moon, there was a little bit of a coup. There were a lot of scientists who got together and wrote the White House and said, what the heck are we doing wasting our time and money on a space station when it's a lot easier and a lot cheaper to go to the moon? If we went to the moon and we built a base there, that would be a better platform to launch our ultimate goal to get to Mars. So we need to be on the moon. It's what makes the most sense, and it's ridiculous that we haven't gone back there. And right after that, George Bush came out and said, we're going back to the moon. And, of course, you also have these stories of other countries such as Japan and India wanting to launch, and China launching craft and talking about going to the moon. So a lot of interest on the moon. Well, Buzz Aldrin is coming back and trying to rehype up that project to go to the moon, and he's talking about, you know, the reason we need to go to the moon is because there's lots of interesting things out there. It gets us closer to Mars, and he says on Mars you're going to find there is a large, strange monolith on one of Mars' moons that is so mysterious nobody knows who put it there, and that's what he says. We don't know why it's there. Some people have been arguing, well, you know, he could be referring to, you know, a monolith is typically and traditionally referred to as a natural formation. But, you know, if you watch this video, he really seems to allude to that it's something strange. In fact, there's a quote that I read, and I haven't been able to substantiate, you know, whether or not he had actually said this, but he talked about that they must have built this monolith on Mars before they came to Egypt and built the pyramids. Some people think he was kidding on that, but wow, what are some amazing things to say. And Buzz Aldrin, you know, you may know, has kind of waffled back and forth on UFO sightings that he's had on his missions to the moon. So Larry King, he actually denied it, but just prior to that on a BBC documentary, he was talking about, yeah, we saw a UFO and we were smart enough because we didn't want the, we knew the public was listening to us. We didn't want them to panic. So we never used the term UFO when we talked about this unknown object that we were watching. Weird and strange stuff. Also, the Obama's press secretary was asked about UFOs on the television show that he was on. And the viewer who called in and asked the show did a great job. He said, you know, this a lot of people laugh at this subject. If you could please take this serious, because a lot of people do, and answer my question seriously. He talked about, you know, Edgar Mitchell talks about Roswell and how it's real. There are very many credible people who are serious about UFOs. And, you know, because you and the president are talking about transparency in government, are you going to look towards sharing information on UFOs with us, the public? And, he responded very well and serious. And this is Press Secretary Gibbs, and said, you know, we haven't talked about this, but thank you for asking your question. And I know you're serious about it. But, you know, we do believe in transparency in government. So if it were to come up, that would be our stance. So interesting stuff. Another very hot story this week is the Russian Navy. The Russian Navy has released some UFO records and some very interesting stories about UFOs coming out of the ocean. In fact, they talk a lot about sightings of UFOs by the Russian, you know, when they're out there in the ocean. So those are some great stories. And I got an interesting email from Bruce McAbee, who is a doctor and physicist, and he is going to be one of our speakers at the MUFON Symposium next weekend. But he said that he was told by a Japanese military man, that these Russian Navy stories, a couple of these stories way back in the early 90s, and now we're seeing them come to light from the Russian Navy. So really interesting stuff there. Richard Dolan, something that he just finished his new book this week, so you can go check that out. KeyholePublishing.com is his website, but his books are around UFO history, essentially. He calls them, you know, the national security state. And this book is 638 pages, full of information. This is UFOs and the national security state, same name as his last book, but this is 73 to 91. And I mean, talk about comprehensive. He really goes bit by bit over a lot of subjects, no holds barred, very taking all of this very open-mindedly, you know, trying not to be judgmental. I was reading the chapter on the aviary. A lot of people curious about this group of supposed insiders that are talking about UFOs. So it looks great. So I'm really excited about this book, so you'll have to check that out. And then finally, a story written by a site, UFOCon. And this is a site that recently wrote another cool big story that had came out, Anthony Bragaglia, and I got to meet this guy one day, but his story was Deep Secrets of a UFO Think Tank Exposed. Is he talking about the UFO think tank that you and I are so familiar with? No, he's talking about the RAND Corporation and about how the RAND Corporation was tasked to have some think tanks to discuss and tackle the UFO subject. So really interesting stuff. Great story. Remember, you can go to ufothinktank.com and see this stuff on the front page. If you scroll down, you can look at the Yahoo Groups link off of the Blog Talk if you're on that. If you are a podcaster, you will need to either go to Yahoo Groups and Google UFO Think Tank or search for UFO Think Tank, or go to the ufothinktank.com. That's where you should go because there's more interesting stuff there. So in honor of the MUFON Symposium, we've got another MUFON-centric show tonight with Roger Marsh, who is actually the Director of Communications for MUFON. Let's bring him on the line. And ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be wonderful. Roger.
Hey, Alejandro. Great to be here.
All right. Great. Thanks for joining us. Reading you loud and clear. So it's good to have you on the show.
Thanks. Lots of good stuff going on out there lately.
Yeah, no kidding. Just tons of things going on. So let's start with the basics. Let's start with how you got involved with all of this.
Most recently?
Actually, way back.
Oh, way back.
Assuming that you've been involved with UFOs way back.
Sure. I mean, the quick history with me is that my parents saw a disc-shaped UFO outside that was hovering like across the street, you know, in the sky above their apartment back in the mid-50s. So as a kid growing up in southwestern Pennsylvania, I was hearing these stories, and they were bringing, you know, whatever magazines and books that were available back in that era home, and, you know, kind of very low-key in that era, discussing it. But growing up where I did in Westmoreland County, you know, south of Pittsburgh, that was, in that era, was a kind of a hotbed for UFO activity, especially when you got up to about 1973, 1974. Just hundreds and hundreds of UFO sightings were going on. And actually, at the age of 16, I actually witnessed a UFO. It was a disc-shaped object. It was the all lit up like the color, same color as the moon, and it. I was just standing just after dark in a suburban neighborhood with about a dozen other kids, and somebody yelled, "Hey, look at that!" And they pointed down the street, and this object was coming right down the street, right at us, and actually went directly over top of us. So I was probably within 25 or 30 feet of the object, which was completely silent, you know, a large object, and it was just this weird feeling when it went above you at this 25 or 30 feet. You just sort of heard the displacement of the air, kind of like a swishing sound. Being Pennsylvania, the rolling hills, it was following the lay of the land, and it went down over the hill. What I did not know at that time was that there were hundreds of other people reporting exactly the same object. Now, that object actually came back, because if you can imagine, a few dozen people actually witnessed it at low level. It sort of panicked the neighborhood, and, you know, 20 or 30 of us gathered on a front lawn, and the object actually came back twice that night, but at a much higher elevation both times. But what it did is it came in into the sky. We saw it. It was the same object, just, again, instead of 30 feet off the ground, now it's probably about, you know, 1,000 feet up off the ground, you know, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 feet. And it sort of shot across the sky. And like you hear many UFO reports where people say, hey, it moved into my airspace and was doing a show for me. And that's what we all thought. This thing came into our line of sight and just stopped and hovered. Then it sort of dropped low to the ground, you know, moved over to the right a little bit, shot straight up. It did that a couple of times. And then we could hear military jets coming into the area. And the thing just took off, like just shot incredibly, at an incredibly fast speed away from us. The military jets came in, circled the area above us, and then took off in the direction of the UFO. Within minutes of that, two light airplanes came in and did the exact same thing. And then the entire sequence repeated itself about 30 minutes later.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my basic introduction.
Yeah. So that was during the day when you first saw it? Or was that night?
Yes.
When it came right over you 30 feet?
Right. That was the same day. It was just after dark, and probably like, okay. I would say within an hour later, the second sighting happened.
So was it lit up?
Yes, it was lit up. We were describing it at the time as about the same color as the moon.
Huh.
Silent.
So,
disc-shaped, you know, round.
So to estimate, if you think you were only 30 feet away from it, how big do you think this thing was?
Oh, this was probably, I would say, about 30 feet across.
Yeah, and then, and what year was this?
This was 1973.
Wow, incredible. That's the year I was born, by the way. Yeah, that is quite exciting. That's really incredible. And, you know, it's interesting for you to say, and now that you've been looking at the reports, let's see if you have any correlation. I hear
sure.
a lot about, and even in my own sightings, or at least one of them, of light planes being in the area soon after. Have you heard about that much before?
I've heard a little bit of that. It's usually the military style jets or what they call the black helicopters coming in. I'm sure there's a few stories out there with the light planes coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing's ringing a bell right now. It's usually the military jets are coming in or the helicopters.
Yeah. Someone asked what a light plane was, and that's like a two-seater, like a Cessna or something.
Or a Piper,
and,
right? Yeah. Single engine, usually.
Yeah, or a Piper. I usually think, you know, it would be a brilliant way. I mean, especially, let's take Denver, for instance. You can have a light plane in the air very quickly. You can observe the area. You can see who might have seen what, and it would be very inconspicuous. No one would think twice about, you know, a Piper up there. And also, you know, they send jets up there. These things take off. You know, the speed difference between one of our jets versus a
right.
Cessna is probably nothing compared to the speed that these things take off at.
Right, but have you ever noticed in all of those kinds of stories, it's as
mm-hmm.
though you could stand back and say, wait a minute, somebody's orchestrating this from a base somewhere where,
mm-hmm.
hey, we have a sighting, and they're sending, you know, the jets out. But in every case, the UFO doesn't hang around. I mean, whenever those jets come in or the helicopters come in, the UFO takes off. So,
yeah.
I'm always predicting they never catch up with it. So they're more or less trying to, I assume, possibly trying to chase it away, if this is sort of a long term thing, where it's being operated or manipulated, you know, somewhere in the U.S., at least from a single base somewhere, where they send out orders to multiple bases across the country. But I would assume chasing them away or gathering data, whatever they can. They're probably photographing them too. I mean, they would actually be stupid if they don't have cameras on these jets. And there's probably a ton of video footage that we don't know about. Minor observation.
Oh yeah, no doubt. Just because even in World War II with gun turret cameras and things like that, you hear about. Video or film being confiscated. But I think you're right, and I've heard stories from people who have claimed to be insiders, who have claimed to be in the military in, you know, a headquarters where they're trying to chase this thing and coordinate between multiple bases to launch craft, you know, in the path. But these things, of course, can so outmaneuver them that they don't have a chance. So I don't know, but then you hear about all the crashes. So you also, let's talk about this real quick. You've also done, before really you got involved with the MUFON stuff and the Examiner, you at least made one movie about UFOs, right?
Well, it was that was my comedy that I did. Mars Attacks Mount Pleasant. That was based on one of my Chicago stage shows that I had out here. This was a series. It was a serial. These were one-hour radio dramas, but they were performed on stages in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And the first episode was Mars Attacks Chicago. And part of my style as a writer is when I produce, especially a stage performance in an area, I let the script absorb that area. So when the idea popped to take that particular stage show and expand it into a full-length film and then set it in southwestern Pennsylvania, in Westmoreland County, the area that I originally grew up in, I had to pull actual real stories and real people from that area and insert them into the script. And we needed some kind of a fantastic ending to the story. And, of course, very famous in that area is the Kecksburg crash from December 9, 1965. Unlike Roswell, which is, I'm sure, a multi-million dollar enterprise for that town, in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, the story is sort of overlooked by the local volunteer fire department. So I actually went down to the fire department, made a presentation to them, and got their full support to use that story. Now, I didn't, I didn't talk down the story. We took the story as a real story, but these people were trying to, in the film, the characters were trying to claim that the mothership was coming back for the crashed ship. And so they were kind of joking with it. And in the film, the actual fire department comes at the end of the film. I don't want to give it away, but they sort of come in and foil, you know, their attempts. And we actually used the actual fire truck and firemen from Kecksburg.
Oh, wow.
So there was a UFO connection in it. My first film was Haunted R&R Station, which was a docudrama where I went into a haunted hotel in Pennsylvania, spent a week inside the hotel shooting, and we did this like hour and a half long docudrama. My third film, which is not out yet, it's a short called Legend of Lillian Peacock. It's fiction, it's comedy, and that should be out sometime probably in early 2010. And at the moment, I'm actually focusing on just paranormal, UFO and paranormal stories, and I'm interested in producing webisodes right now. So I'm actually off on an adventure at the end of this month, end of August, going up to a small town in New York State, and we're actually shooting 21 episodes at one site. And then we're going down into Pennsylvania to another small haunted hotel and probably doing 5 or 6 episodes down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of Kecksburg and Pennsylvania, one thing I forgot to mention was one of the biggest researchers in that area, Stan Gordon, who's pretty much the expert on Kecksburg. You've been working with him as well.
In fact, Stan and I just finished a book recently, and we covered what happened in 1973-74. That book is called Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot casebook. And I'm imagining that that's probably going to come out sometime in probably the first half of 2010. That story, by the way, it has been covered by a couple of networks as episodes in productions that they've done. There was a Canadian company that came down that did something. A few books have mentioned it, but there's never been a single book on that particular era, what happened. Because if you look back into 1973, the year of your birth, 73-74, UFO researchers were not talking to the Bigfoot researchers, and the Bigfoot researchers were not talking to ufologists. It just didn't happen. So Stan Gordon
and they
had...
still don't.
To a point, they probably still don't. But I think the door is a little open a little wider today. But back in that era, you know, here he was, the main UFO, you know, gatherer for the state of Pennsylvania, where even the police agencies, state and local police, they would forward the UFO calls over to his hotline, and here all of these Bigfoot reports are coming in. Well, the state and local police, they had no idea what to do with them. Hey, Stan Gordon, let's send the calls over to him. And what he found very quickly over time was that you would have one person reporting a low-level UFO hovering, okay, very close to the ground. And then a couple of hours later, he gets a phone call from another family. They don't even know the first family. They live very close to the first family, but they access their home from a different road. And they're saying, hey, last night, same time as the UFO sighting, they're seeing, you know, two or three Bigfoot creatures on their land. And it was just, it was an incredible story. Probably the Uniontown case was probably the wildest case that happened, which actually occurred also in 1973. Are you familiar with that case at all from Uniontown?
No, I'm not. Well, I've heard of it, but I can't remember the details. But yeah, go ahead.
It well, basically, a farmer and his family saw this disc-shaped UFO coming down onto their property, and their son and a couple of, I believe, boys from the neighborhood, you know, younger kids, they jumped into a pickup truck, and they drove up to the site on their property where they saw this thing. And they got out of the pickup truck, and they were sort of looking down at it. They were up, like, on a hill looking down, you know, just a couple of hundred feet from them, and they could see this thing. And the young man pulled a rifle out of his pickup truck and fired at the ship. And as he pulled the trigger, the entire UFO, just in a blink of an eye, it just disappeared. And at the same moment that it disappeared, it left behind light. The entire ground on that spot was lit up in the same circumference as the UFO was. And they saw two Bigfoot creatures approaching that area. And, of course, that panicked them. In fact, one of the boys just took off running. It was just such a horrible scene. The others jumped back into the pickup truck, went back to the farmhouse. They called the state police. State policemen came out to the scene. And, of course, the UFO wasn't there, but the ground was still lit up. And the man actually remarked that you could read a newspaper. I mean, this was, like, pretty late at night, 10, 11 o'clock at night. And he said you could read a newspaper, you know, at that scene. And then they started hearing sounds, and I might be slightly off on this. I haven't read this story in a little bit, but I believe he did actually see the Bigfoot creature. He either saw it or, with the sound and everything going on, the guy panicked and went running back to his cruiser. And then later that same night, Stan Gordon and his crew went out there, and I won't give away the ending to that story because it's in the book, but some very, very odd things happened, you know, that night.
Cool.
So,
you know, I want to get back into the Bigfoot thing because it's interesting. I was shocked how open people were in the UFO community to the whole concept of Bigfoot, and open to more broader ideas, and it seemed like the Bigfoot community was. But we'll get into that more. I want to hear some more about that. But let's get into, you know, your job now. And I think you've become, you know, a major focal point in this field with your examiner.com articles. And it would seem that the viewership or the massive amount of hits you're getting also reflects that.
Yeah, it's incredible. I started out actually in very early January. That was just a couple weeks after James Carrion and I had discussed me coming in and working with MUFON. And I was looking for ways of promoting them. At the same time, I'm a writer, and I was looking for a new gig at that point. You know, what am I going to do? I just finished my third film. And I'm one of these people that I have to always be, you know, planning and doing something different for my future. Definitely not a corporate kind of a person. So I thought, oh, yeah, you know, I've been interested in UFOs all my life. I actually produced a couple of books in the 90s, you know, with a neat writer out of QFOS. And I just, you know, I saw the Examiner. Everything clicked. You know, I went right into it. I was originally the Chicago UFO Examiner, and within a couple of weeks, my hits were, you know, doing so well that they agreed to make me the National UFO Examiner. And just it's just incredible. Between the phone calls that I get, the emails that I get, the comments that I get on my stories, it just exploded. And within just barely 6 months into the gig, I had exceeded 1 million page hits, as you said. The Examiner is predicting that I'm probably going to exceed about 3 million. I'm predicting about 3.5 million by year's end.
For the year? Wow.
For the year, just looking at where I'm at now, but every couple of weeks, it just the numbers seem to come up just a little bit higher. Just the phone calls I get from the researchers all over the country. Every month I get to know more and more of the state directors within MUFON. Of course, I need their permission to talk with their field investigators, to trade the reports going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been going along very well. What's really incredible, and I know I did not plan this in the beginning, but as you were telling your listeners, you know, I'm there at the, you know, MUFON CMS watching all this stuff come in, you know, the hundreds of reports that are coming in monthly. I'm reading every report, and I'm kind of picking and choosing, you know, which ones I'm going to highlight, which ones I'm going to write about, which ones become an independent story as opposed to getting into my UFO traffic report for Monday, Wednesday, Friday. What I did not predict was the witnesses, the high number of witnesses that read their story in my columns, and then they get in touch with me, and they want to talk. And what's neat for them, which doesn't – I'm sure it exists in different areas, different websites, different forums, but I think what they like about it is that it's like a forum area where they can discuss and openly talk about what happened to them. And I knew going in that the writing was going to be tough, that there may be some people coming down on me. And I know I got some flack early on where people were saying, hey, you know, these are uninvestigated reports. You know, don't write about them until everybody's had a chance to totally investigate the case and, you know, come up with the conclusions. My reaction was that that's like, you know, a building burning down and the fire chief telling me I can't write the story until they've done their complete investigation. So I made a choice as a writer that I was going to cover ufology from the witness level. I'm going to let the witnesses talk. But I do, in every story, maybe ad nauseum, but in every story, I do warn people that these are uninvestigated stories. Occasionally, you know, do we get spoofed? Yes, we do. There's people out there that just every now and again, I guess they have nothing better to do than to just make up a story, you know, and write it. So some of those do pop up. But I think mainly... it's people, you know, from the heart, they're writing, you know, this is what happened.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I agree with you, too, because I think it's important and a big story itself just the fact that we have these hundreds of people reporting sightings. And like you found, these are, for the most part, not people perpetrating hoaxes.
No.
They're people who are genuinely having sightings and they're curious about what they saw. Many times we find they have seen something mundane, but still I think that in itself is pretty incredible.
Well, I think there's a learning curve out there for people, because if you could gather, you know, 24 of the best ufologists in the country, put them into one room, they'll all agree on probably the top 2 or 3 things that people see that they mistake for a UFO, you know, and maybe it's a star. You know, there's certain things that they'll point out, like, you know, oh, no, that's all it was. So you have a lot of these reports, which are the bright light cases. and they're stationary. And I'm a little bit, you know, okay, I'm not going to report on all of those, you know, just a few of them. But you learn over time reading these reports, and I've certainly read now thousands of them, you know, when it's just a bright light, so it's not really a shape. It's not, you know, the triangular, you know, UFO at ground level, okay? It's this bright light off in the distance. What gets me is the fact that we're not seeing the blinking lights on them, which the FAA would require. And then you look at the movement of that light, how it's going to shoot across the sky. It's going to stop. It's going to drop down maybe to ground level, shoot off, or it might just disappear, you know, altogether. So it's quite interesting, but I think there's a learning curve for the public. I do think there are some people out there that are reporting things that are not UFOs, but I say, hey, let it happen. Let them get those stories out there in an environment where there's dialogue, and dialogue among the ufologist, and dialogue among even the armchair ufologists out there. Every once in a while, somebody comes down on me in a comment, and they're like, how dare you waste my time with this video or with this photo? And I'll write back, and I'll say, hey, thanks for the comment, but, you know, do you all really want me to pick and choose? Do you want me to pick and choose what the public can and can't see? Now sure, I do pick. I don't put every report in there. I would seriously have to be completely 110% full-time doing that. I mean, and I do, honest to God, on most days I work 12-hour days, 7 days a week, and it's all spent on ufology right now. There's going to be a little mix of a change coming up, but right now I'm pretty much noon to midnight, 7 days a week, and I try to work everything else, you know, around that. I do try to take a day off once in a while, but I always have my ear like, right, I always come back to that, you know, MUFON. I got to get over to the CMS, you know, and see what's happened.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, okay.
Your stories are too important. We can't let you take a day off. I think it's been incredible, you know, how prolific you've been, where you have two or three stories coming out a week. I think that attests to why
two or three stories a day.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as far as I've seen, there's nobody on Examiner writing two or three stories a day about pets or anything.
Well, yeah, it's sort of the way that I assess the reports. I look at them and I say, okay, you know, either I'm going to ignore the report. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a real, you know, good report, but there are some, you know, with just the bright light cases that I'll be like, okay, you know, or the obvious hoaxes, you know, the obvious ones, you know, you can root those out real easy. But a story either belongs in a UFO traffic report, which I've already said that it comes out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and that can be anywhere from 8 to 18 reports in general, you know, 3 days a week. And if not, I also look for those cases that really need to be their own story. You know, university professor, that's where I get to write the really cool headlines too, you know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't have it right here in front of me, but it would be like, you know, UFO lands near elementary schoolyard. Okay.
Right.
We don't know yet what that craft was. It's still unidentified. It's still a UFO, but we do have a pretty neat report, you know, of this thing coming down. It's pretty neat if I get a good case and I also get a piece of artwork to go with it. You know, I'm very, very tuned into the artwork. You know, when I can't have that, I look within the story. And in the case of that elementary school, for example, you know, they gave me enough information that I was able to use Google Maps and go to ground level and get pretty darn close to that grade school, you know, to get my readers right, you know, right there in the mix of the story. That's what I'm trying to do, is bring the reader right down to the actual story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of people wanted to hear some details about that elementary school story.
Oh, let me see if I can find that one here. Yeah, that one just happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was in Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah, some people, hey, I'm in Arizona, I want to hear about that in the chat here.
Well, the town is Rita Ranch, Arizona. The witnesses first thought that they were watching a helicopter descending into their neighborhood with these two, like, orangish-white flashing lights, and then there was another light that flashed red. And it appeared as though the object was going to land near this elementary school, just south of their home on the street is actually Reese Loop, R-E-E-S, Reese Loop. They said there was no sound coming from the object, and then it disappeared from their view, you know, below a line of homes. But then about 10 minutes later, they saw the same object now ascending up into the sky. They ran outside into the backyard, and they watched this object moving off into the, you know, west-northwest area toward Davis-Mothan Air Force Base, which was very close to this location. This was about 11:15 at night on July the 30th. But when it went down, remember, there was no sound. But as it was going up, they noticed this whirring sound that they said was that sounded like a jet engine, but a very high-pitched in tone, like when a jet engine first starts up.
Mm-hmm.
And this sound stayed steady as they watched it sort of slowly fly over the neighborhood until they lost sight of it.
Did anybody happen to record that sound that you know of?
I do not know. Yeah,
Probably not.
Yeah, they did not mention that in the story. Which, you know, most cases when these things happen, man, there's just not time. Even if you have a camera on you. I can't imagine taking my eyes off the UFO. I know that my own cell phone has like a 6-megapixel, you know, camera on it and video. But as much as I know how that cell phone works, you know, I don't use the camera that often. I would have to, like, look at it. Oh, I got to push this button and then this one, and, you know, boom, the object's gone, you know. And
I hear you because I've been in that situation where at least, especially one of my sightings I got on video, and I don't really show it because I don't think the video itself is that impressive. It's to me because of what I saw along with that video. But at least another time I could have gone and grabbed the binoculars, my first sighting, but I was just, like you, I didn't want to take my eyes off of this thing. And it's so important to see how it disappears, you know?
Yes.
If it streaks off or not. Getting into some other of these cases, there have been a lot of triangle sightings lately, it seems.
Yeah, I noticed that in May and June, the numbers had kind of risen from let's say, I'm only going back to January. By the time we got to May, June of 2009, it was incredible. I had covered like probably 35, 40 cases in each of those months. Then all of a sudden we hit July, and especially over that July 4th weekend, when suddenly it was the orbs or the orange lights that people were seeing, which was that was incredible, what came through MUFON over July 4th and since. And then we kind of, you know, from there it moved out, and all of a sudden I was seeing a lot of these sphere objects, really good cases on that. But I agree with you that the triangles are definitely back. In fact, right now my top three favorite cases, two of the three are triangle cases that happened between April and July. But yeah, they're definitely back. But there's a great case out of Oklahoma from May 18th and a really neat case out of Michigan from April 5. Both of those cases are triangles, very, very low to the ground. I mean, we're talking probably, you know, at 30 feet or lower to the ground that these things came down. In the Michigan case, I just heard from the Michigan MUFON director recently, who turned me over to the field investigator, and they've marked that case as a true unknown.
Mm-hmm. And I know at least in one of those cases, there was witnesses had drawn pictures, or at least one had, and it looked very similar to what we see in a lot of these cases, with each edge having a light on it, or each point of the triangle having a light on it, and one light in the middle.
Yeah, that is your typical. I was talking to some other people recently where they were kind of joking on the models of these things, that there's kind of two different triangle crafts that are kind of the two main ones. One has more sharp edges to it, and one has more rounded edges to it. We were kind of joking how American cars had kind of rounded out. They had come out with their new model somewhere. But, they mainly have these three lights on them at each of the three points of the triangle, and then the single light underneath, which is usually red.
Mm-hmm.
And these crafts are so real and so frightening. They are able to move incredibly fast or just hover silently. And anytime somebody says to me, you know, hey, Raj, this has got to be something new that the military has out there. It's got to be. We're seeing them at ground level. We're seeing so many of them. So I always throw the question out, and I say, okay, let's pretend it is the U.S. military. It is their latest stealth aircraft. It's a great thing. You know, I'm sure in the next 5 or 10 years we're going to hear all about it. If that's the case, why are they out scaring the American public with it? You know what I mean? Why are they creeping up on some woman, you know, in an Oklahoma ranch, you know, in a remote area, late at night while she's feeding her horses, okay? And this is the Oklahoma case from May the 18th. Why would they be doing that?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense to me that they would be creeping up on people. But if you're going to test these, you're going to test them out in the desert. You know, let's go on out to Area 51 or someplace where we can at least know that the population's extremely low. I'm sure there's many places they could go to experiment, but why would they go into these areas? Or in many cases, very populated areas that they're going into.
Yeah, and I know that at least NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Sciences, they had done a study on the triangles, and you can still find that out there, and they had determined that they weren't ours. It's always a hard one. You hear these stories of TR-3Bs that are supposedly that's what these are. These are these man-made anti-gravity type of devices. I've heard stories. This is an interesting one. They're these huge dirigibles that use a bit of anti-gravity to make them light so they can transport huge amounts of tanks and armor and people and everything. So, yeah, you hear a lot of these stories, but like you said, you know, why fly these over populated areas?
Right, but even if you take the stories from the low population areas, why would you be the pilot saying, hey, look, there's a woman feeding her horses. Come on, you know, let's
check
her
out.
I mean, because what is she going to think? It's a triangle ship. It's silent.
The
pilot's got to know what's going on. If it's an American pilot, man, he's in trouble when they find out what he did. Because these stories are going to pop up. I mean, I'm just one writer out there. So my take is I'm kind of ruling it out that, you know, but of course my take also is that the government, you know, after Project Blue Book, they've never stopped studying UFOs. I mean, there's probably, you know, hundreds of people, you know, maybe thousands of people working within the government that are constantly tracking these things and trying to come up with, you know, an understanding of what they are, where they come from. Are they part of our Earth? They're another species that's here? Are they coming from somewhere else? Are they interdimensional? You know the list of theories. We just don't know. The government might know a little bit more than we know, but I suspect that they don't know that much more.
Even if that's always a hard one.
Well, even if they have some of the crashed ships, you know, and maybe they're back engineering, and, you know, of course people are saying that, you know, that technology is what's been propelling us the last, you know, 50 years, you know, through our computers and cell phones and all these neat things and, you know, sticky notes that we have, you know. I don't know. It's anybody's guess right now. In fact, so somebody was just asking me, because they're kind of new to ufology, and I found it kind of interesting, that they asked me the question that any time one of these crafts gets close to the ground, is there radiation evidence? And I really couldn't answer that, except to say that I had probably heard of that in the past, that the Geiger counters are out, and yes, there's some kind of radiation. Same person also asked me if people are being harmed by UFOs. And I said, in general, no. Yes, we have those cases. I know UFO hunters profiled a case. I can't recall where that was. I'm thinking Texas, where the two women with the boy in the car and the UFO came over.
Oh, yeah, that was a John Schuessler's case, actually. And that was, in Texas.
Texas, okay. That's what I thought.
He's written a book, The Cash Landrum Case. You can look up on that.
Okay, well, we have a case there that if that was a true UFO,
right.
Yes, these people were harmed by it. But in most cases, it just looks like they're observing, or maybe there's some other activity that they're up to. You know, I don't know. Is it minerals? Is it water? You know, what is it? Are they replenishing something in their craft that makes them need to come down to ground level? But obviously, we're almost like bugs. They just sort of, you know, they look at us, but yet they seem to be able to control our electronics. They can shut our automobiles down. In fact, I just covered a case recently where the guy said that his it was the university professor at from Kansas City. That case I just wrote about, and he said that it was an orange sphere that came down, and he said it was the size of a grapefruit if you held it at arm's length, which would be a pretty large craft. And he watched it, and I don't have the story in front of me, but it was a number of minutes, like 6 or 7 minutes, that he watched this thing hovering over campus. And just naturally, he grabbed his cell phone to call his wife to tell her what he was witnessing. And his cell phone said that, you know, no cells. You're not in an area where you can, you know, get reception. And as soon as the UFO disappeared, boom, the cell phone went right back on.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of just like your other comments about the government. I always think about the media and TV shows and things and the different levels of possible government knowledge, such as you had that show Dark Skies or Steven Spielberg's Taken, where it's kind of like what you talked about. They're looking into this. They're trying to figure it out, but they don't know what the heck's going on. Then you have Stargate, where there are these huge programs.
Right.
Or you have Men in Black, where, you know, they're interacting and working together, and they're all here and everything. So I like to use those to kind of imagine what scenario fits, but it's hard to know. You know, it's so difficult with all the information we have to know at what level of interaction our government actually has.
Yeah, and of course, everybody's talking about the Obama administration and are they going to be the ones to reveal. And honestly, I know that's an area. I'm leaving that up to other writers, you know, to cover that. I don't think the Obama administration is going to do it. I think that eventually they're going to have to do it in the next 5 to 10 years, as you see technology changing. I mean, just look at the way digital cameras have changed in the last 5 or 10 years. You know, I know my sister out in California recently, and I'm going to get the number wrong here, but she bought something like a a 40, I'm sure I'm exaggerating, but like a 40, what's the thing for cameras? I'm sorry, I'm blanking here.
ASA?
Well, megapixel, that's it, I'm sorry.
Oh,
she
megapixel,
like a,
40 megapixel, whoa.
Whoa, yeah, I mean, it's the latest Canon, and I'm probably exaggerating the number there a little bit, but, you know, whatever I've got, I saw her photographs that she just took on a recent trip, and it just blew me away, you know, talking about going from black and white TV to high definition, you know, these are Kathleen's photos, you know.
Yeah, well, I think of my iPhone here is just blows me away. You can't tell me this is not alien technology, you know, making these pictures go in and out and I can communicate. I mean, it really is incredible. That's why I put some credence into the whole Colonel Corso scenario where he took Roswell debris and farmed that out to different companies.
Yeah, the only problem I have with that is is somewhere along the line, there's a lot of people that would have to be involved in that. And, you know, somebody's got to come forward at some point, or a lot
well,
more
necessarily.
People.
Not necessarily. All he would have to do is give this stuff to one person. All you would need, and which is what he said he did. And it would only be then just a very small amount of people. If these are already projects in progress, which is the genius of how he did it.
Well, it's like the Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. The one had the device that they show the guy, the scientist, like, in the future, you know, and this was developed from alien technology. They were looking at alien technology, and they were trying to back-engineer something. It was, you know, it was incredible. But, you know, I mean, even in my lifetime, like, even just in the last 3-4 years, like, I've been out in malls or shopping areas wearing a UFO T-shirt, and it'll usually be like a retired guy that will stop me, you know, from former military, who will say, well, what do you know about UFOs? You know, and I'll be like, hey, introduce myself. And every time they'll tell me, if you only knew what I knew, and we're not allowed to talk about it, you know.
Right.
I just heard a case. It was a neat case. I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying this if I don't use anybody's names. But I just heard of a case where a guy he's in a retirement home. And it's a group of, you know, people there, and they're all telling, you know, their own personal stories about their life. And he talked about being on an aircraft carrier during World War II. And he said that these objects, they were out, you know, in the ocean, you know, way out somewhere. And these objects were coming in and out of the water, in and out of the ocean all night long. That they actually got deck chairs out and were sitting and watching. And then later, the higher-ups, you know, talked to them and said, you know, you realize this never happened. You are not permitted to talk about this ever. And the guy's like, you know, on his deathbed saying, well, now I want to talk about it because I'm about to go. And I just keep hearing these stories over and over again from just so many people from so many different countries, saying that, gee, if you only knew what I knew. If we could just gather them all
together. Yeah, I hear
that.
And these are older gentlemen. I mean, when I've had the same thing happen, and these are, you know, retired people who, you know, are very credible.
Yeah, in fact, I'm working with a guy right now, this shoot that I'm doing up in Hinsdale, New York, at the end of the month. We're going up there to recreate, actually, an exorcism that happened in 1974. And the Michael Rambacher, who's my site coordinator up there, he's the local guy that, you know, he knows the story and has been overseeing the story for the last maybe almost 20 years. He worked one time at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And, in fact, what year was the Roswell crash? That was 1947?
Right.
Okay, so, and he said this was 20 years later to the day, just a coincidence probably. So we're in 1967, and he was the guy who was on the gate at night for overnight. And, of course, at that time, this was when Alan Hynek, Dr. Hynek, had his office there in Project Blue Book. He used to let Alan Hynek in and out of the base all the time. And he said this one night that this UFO was like a sphere, and it came right down the runway. He got on the phone. He was at one of the runways. I think he was at Wright, and he called over to Patterson and got the same guy at the gate over there said, "Are you seeing this?" The guy said, "What?" And then he went, "Oh, wow, here it comes." And he claims that it actually clipped the engine. It actually clipped I can't think of what type of aircraft it was, but it was a aircraft, I believe, that was taking off. And it clipped this plane, and one of the engines fell off of it. They didn't crash. They didn't make it back to the base. But whatever this thing was, it went right down the runway. And he said it was just incredible. And, of course, he was called into the offices, from a higher up. It was actually the same building that Alan Hynek was in, and he was told that it never happened. And then a short time later, he and some of the other people that saw it, they were all transferred to very remote bases. And I may get this story wrong, but I think he actually was shipped over to China somewhere. I mean, wherever it was,
wow.
I have the notes somewhere, but it was so incredible. It was almost like they wanted to take the witnesses and scatter them. And, his story is you have to have just been there to have experienced this. But that was 1967, and the story's never been told.
Yeah, there's so many of these, and but I do want to talk about someone else in the chat had asked about July 4th, and I know you had paid attention. They said in particular July 4th Pennsylvania sightings, but if I'm not right, you noticed a wave of sightings throughout the country on the weekend of the 4th.
There were certainly many, many sightings in Pennsylvania, my home state. These sightings were actually all across the country. And, of course, we're all laughing. In fact, I just was emailing earlier tonight with the MUFON director from Missouri, Debbie, we're kind of laughing at people trying to say that all of these reports were the result of Chinese lanterns. And we all know how the Chinese lantern works, that it moves, within the wind, as the wind would blow it. These orange lights that we saw all across the country on July 4th weekend, these were definitely something intelligent was controlling these. They were not necessarily moving with the wind. They were hovering. There were just dozens and dozens and dozens. I didn't even add them all up in the end. In fact, in the end, I was picking and choosing which were the better ones that I was going to put in. It's just that incredible. And I know that right now, in fact, Missouri, they have reported to me, again, this is coming from the MUFON state director, that Missouri right now is having, especially the Kansas City area, that they are having a rash of orange lights. And Debbie wanted me to point out that the lights, as far as the size of them, that they are getting reports as small as the size of a car and as large as the size of a house. It's just incredible.
Yeah, and it seems like that's also been... the orange orb seemed to also be around a lot lately, just like the professor that you had spoken about earlier.
Yeah, it's the orbs, or sometimes they refer to them as a sphere. Many times they are orange. That was the university professor in that case. And then, like, for example, in Sedona, Arizona on July 19th, I got to write a great headline with this one because I refer to it now as the honeymooners case. They stepped out on their balcony and saw this sphere in the sky, and they shot videotape of it. And I think it's a pretty darn good video. Of course, July 27th was that University of Missouri at Kansas City case where he said it was the size of a grapefruit, you know, held at arm's length.
Right.
But, yeah, many, 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 many cases. My favorite case right now is my number one favorite case at the moment occurred on July 5, that same weekend. Originally, there were three witnesses. There was a fourth witness that came into the story much later. I don't know the town yet on this one. California's MUFON's being a little quiet on this one, I assume, because it's a sensitive investigation. I do know it occurred in California on July 5, and the object that came down on this ranch was cone-shaped. It was a man and his teenage son. There was a third witness there, and they went out, actually, to where this thing landed, and it was gone. And then they were looking the area over, and a fourth witness came in, and they said that it was like they could hear these weird sounds going on where they couldn't see anything. It was all like audio now, but they said the sky opened up like almost like a wormhole was opening up, and something was shooting into it, and then the whole thing closed up.
Holy cow!
Yeah, I'm not giving that story its best. I should have reread that one before the show started, but you know, I'm trying to find out more about that one. I'm getting a lot of reader input; they want to know more. I'm just assuming the investigation's ongoing on that one, and probably that.
And
Oklahoma.
How many witnesses?
There were four total. Three originally saw the craft come in and land.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so we have something on the ground. So I assume that there may be some kind of ground evidence there if the thing actually landed. In fact, they said if it didn't land, it was just within 2 or 3 feet off the ground, if it was not actually touching the ground, you know, from
Holy
their vantage
cow, were
point.
These all people that were together in a group, or were there any, like,
Yeah, they were together. It was the owner of the ranch, okay? Adult male, and it was his teenage son, like 14 or 16 years old, and then the father had a friend over. So it was the three of them,
mm-hmm.
and they noticed this thing coming over and coming down, landing, you know, also silent. It was cone-shaped and, you know, got them very upset. I think they went through the house looking for like flashlights and things like that, and by the time they got down there, the thing wasn't there anymore. And it was just like a couple of minutes to gather up what they needed to get out there, and it was gone. But they were like curious of the sight, like, let's go down to where it was, and it kind of scared them, and then they called another friend to come over, and by the time the fourth guy got there, and they were all standing there, and again, I'm not going to give the story justice without having just read it, but I remember that there was something with weird sounds that were going on, and they all looked up, and the sky, like I said, it opened up like a wormhole was opening, and something from their area was then shooting through this, and then the whole thing closed up.
Mm-hmm.
Very,
so,
very odd.
Yeah, that is an incredible one. I mean, that is so neat because, you know, we assume, and when you talk to physicists, they talk about the possibility, and so many of them talk about the even probability of this wormhole effect being real, even with fairly conventional Einsteinian type of physics. And to actually think of one being seen by people, if that's indeed what it was, that's, I think, pretty amazing.
It is very amazing because I have to laugh at the critics that say, look, you can't get there from here. You know, when they want to kick tires and say, look, you know, people, you know, you can only travel this fast and the nearest star and blah, 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 blah. I just start yawning, you know, because they're here. I mean, give it up.
Yeah,
How they got here. You know, that's sort of secondary to the story. They're here. They're among us. There are no CNN reports out there. Anderson Cooper is not reporting on a day-to-day basis, you know, who got the ray gun today? Who got hit by a ray gun? You know, and the Martians, you know, they killed 30 people in Chicago today when they landed, you know, inadvertently on a schoolyard. You know, those reports are not happening. It's mainly that people are just sort of, it's not planned. You know, they're just seeing them. Although there is another sort of, again, if you've read every report I've read since January, there's a percentage of people who claim that they can see a UFO on demand, or that in fact we even had a state section director who recently came forward and said, look, you know, I went home after the convention and I just said, I want to see a UFO. Let's just telepathically talk to them. And boom, you know, she saw one.
Yeah.
Again, is that a coincidence or is that really something that could happen? I know that also happened with the same percentages with the Bigfoot people, you know, back in Pennsylvania, 73, 74, where somebody was laughing about the stories and said, yeah, I want to see a Bigfoot creature. And by God, one came by the man's house that night. Scared the heck out of him, right?
Yeah.
He's no longer wishing these things on, you know.
Yeah.
You
know, and I got to say, you know, for me, it was, I did the C-SETI protocol. As silly as it sounds, you know, I try to keep an open mind, which includes a meditation and trying to say, hey, come visit and stuff like this. And I'm really into meditation, so I thought, what the heck, I'll try it out. I have to meditate anyway. So, and 30 minutes later, you know, my first sighting. So,
Was
it a coincidence? Completely possible. But, yeah, you know, and I've been around these. I was skeptical of the abduction phenomenon, but I was hearing from these people who felt that they were being abducted, said they saw UFOs a lot. A couple of them showed me videos that were interesting. And sure enough, with two or three of these people, I have been with them, and I have seen things myself. And, of course, I'm much more open to that.
It's also great today. What's also great today that the mainstream ufologists are accepting alien abduction, or that's how it appears right now. I personally feel that it's been going on for a long time. There's a huge percent of the population. It's kind of a scary term, alien abduction. It's scary. Anybody that's been through it, I've experienced it myself as a kid. I have a whole chapter in a book about it. Not understanding it. I'm very thankful that I did get to talk to Dr. John Mack. Spent about an hour with him up at Harvard University discussing it. He, of course, was one of the top, you know, two or three or four alien abduction experts in the country. He's now deceased, of course. Was struck and killed by a car over in London a few years back. But I just think there's something else going on there where these beings are interacting with us, that is how they are interacting. They are studying us. Are we talking about multiple species here? You know, probably. It just seems like, you know, whether of the observer, you know, kind of species just coming in and, you know, probably picking up a little bit of water, a little bit of oxygen, some minerals, whatever they need. And they're moving on. Others, you know, Lord only knows what they're doing. They talk about, you know, the breeding between humans and aliens. You know, I assume that that's probably going on. Thankfully, they're putting people back in their same position, you know, where they left them. They're putting them back. Now, there may be some psychological damage. I was never bothered. You know, and because my experiences happened between the ages of 5 and 16. And after 16, when I told them to just go away, I was not interested in this anymore, and it just stopped at the age of 16. I just thought it was all bad dreams, you know, as real as it all was. But then later in the 80s, I started watching all the TV programs and going, hey, wait a minute. You know, how did these people have the exact same experience that I did, you know?
Wow.
So So, again, it's not mainstream yet, but it's neat that we're all out there dialoguing about it. You know, it's not something that's being laughed at anymore. I don't think so. I think there's a much smaller percentage of the population now. Although I did just a couple months ago, a therapist came by my home to work with my wife, and he was from Western Europe. Can't think of what country he was from, but he came in to work with my wife, inquired what kind of work I did, and he looked at me, and the guy's about 35 years old, you know, a professional, and he said, well, UFOs, he said, that's just all fiction, right? That's not real. I looked at him and said, well, you might want to do a little bit of reading out there. You know, I know Anderson Cooper's not discussing it or, you know, is not reporting on it too often. He might have done a couple of reports. And certainly he's not doing, or CNN, and I shouldn't pick on Anderson Cooper, but in general, the media is not covering it on a daily basis like I am. And I'm just one writer, and I'm just covering one database. You know, one, I mean, MUFON is probably the largest. I know that, of course, we have the, out in Washington State, what is it, the National UFO Reporting Center.
Yeah, NUFORC. They take a lot
Peter
of
Davenport.
Reports.
It is nice to take Peter Davenport's reports once in a while and cross-reference them with what's in MUFON. I just, of course, everybody in the field wishes we had more funding. Everybody's crying for funding. I won't name names, but I've talked to people at the largest organizations, the largest UFO organizations, and the joke is, you know, the little old lady, you know, who's already lost her husband, who has nobody to leave her money to, she's not going to die leaving her, you know, her estate to MUFON. She'll leave it to the Wildlife Foundation first because she doesn't want to be ridiculed even in death. Look at what Margaret did. She left her money to MUFON. Ha, ha, ha. What a crazy lady she was, you know. I suspect in the next...
But,
you know,
they can do that and anonymously. We'll accept anonymous like that. Just
well, I suspect, though, Alejandro, I suspect that in the next decade you're going to see people... now saying, okay, you know, we're giving so much to this organization. Hey, come on, let's give $1,000 to MUFON right now.
Right now,
for example, I have an offer on my webpage. Go on over to QFOS, the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies based here in Chicago, which I might add is within walking distance of my home. But you can get their complete set of International UFO Reporter, which is their quarterly journal, which I think is regularly $100 to get it on a DVD or a CD. They've marked that down, I forget the exact price, $75 or $80, you know, for examiner readers. You know, obviously it's a fundraiser. It's a really interesting, you know, product, you know, to pick up. Would love to see more people go over, you know, to give them more funding. I would love to see MUFON get more funding.
Yeah. Well, before we're done, we've only got a few minutes left, and you hit on a lot of stuff, but I can already tell I'm definitely going to want to have you back, probably even on a quarterly basis to catch up on these stories. But someone did have a great question earlier. We've talked about Pennsylvania being a hot spot lately, Missouri. Are there some other hot spots?
I was afraid that question was going to come up because it's actually on my agenda to try to figure out how to name hotspots, and I'm even trying to put like a board together of people to say, look, here's what I think. Because
the criteria, which makes sense.
Yeah, if I could just get a group of people, you know, even casually, where I could present them the evidence. In fact, Dr. Mark Rodiger, you know, over at QFOS, he and I have discussed this too, that, you know, you'd almost have to go around to all 50 state directors with MUFON and say, look, you know, if you think you have a hot spot in your state, you need to provide the following information. Give us the cases. with the case numbers,
right.
dates, okay? So we can see. You know, I've had, of course, John Ventry, you know, he's been dealing with a hot spot out there in Pennsylvania. Basically, it's in Pennsylvania, for example, it's on the southern half of the state. These things seem to be shooting in from Ohio on the west end, but always, you know, of course, Pittsburgh's in southwestern, Philadelphia's in southeastern Pennsylvania, and they're shooting across the state. Or, of course, they're stopping and, you know, people are seeing them. Just some incredible stuff in Pennsylvania, but it's almost like it's always been going on. But like the July 4th weekend, that was another hot time for Pennsylvania. It was more over on the eastern end of the state, around Philadelphia, maybe within 100 miles of Philadelphia, they were getting most of the activity over there. But
mm-hmm.
other hot spots, you know, Arizona. I've seen a lot of cases popping up. I'm not tracking them by state. I've been trying to keep
right.
track of everything I cover by types of craft, be it, you know, the bright light, the triangle, the cigar-shaped, and, you know, on and on and on, diamond-shaped. I'm about a month behind logging that stuff in, because you can imagine after I'm done writing, I've been trying to do it once a week, and I'm about, like I said, 1 month behind doing that. But there are other, like organizing them by state so we can look for those hot spots. I need four assistants to come over
yeah.
to help me with this stuff and a little bit of funding, and I could probably come up with more of that for you. And if I knew that prior
yeah.
to coming onto the show, I could probably spend a couple of hours and come up with some more areas for you.
No problem. I think you're right, because going state by state doesn't necessarily tell you a whole lot. A state can be a lot of area to cover, as opposed to a hot spot being one particular area. So maybe a first go would be to figure out what states have a disproportionate, because I think what I've found is that sightings do seem to correspond with population. But some areas, it just is disproportionate to the population. But, to figure out an actual hot spot, that would be a neat goal. So I hope you pursue that, because, you know, someone was asking, how do I go see a UFO? And I think the best way to do it would probably be to go to these places where people see a lot of them.
Yeah, I know that. In fact, when I do the shoot out in New York, I'm going to swing down. Well, I have to go to that haunted hotel in Linesville, Pennsylvania. And then I'm going to go down into Westmoreland County and hang out with John Ventry for a while. We're going to do some interviews with him. It'll be, you know, probably a few episodes. And when I say an episode, I mean, like, an episode to me is like up to 10 minutes of video with a story. But if
mm-hmm.
I can link three or four of those together and, you know, with John get two or three or four episodes, and, you know, I'm going to probably be running those on like a Monday, Wednesday, Friday kind of a thing. Both on my UFO Examiner page, and I'm also the National Paranormal News Examiner.
Mm-hmm.
So
cool.
Between the two sites. But, yeah, I hope to get into the research a little bit more. I think every month I sort of come up another notch. Like, for example, somebody said to me, you know, hey, Raj, could you get the MUFON case numbers in there? And I'm like, oh, I can only see what the public can see. I can't see case numbers. And then all of a sudden I noticed it in the code and realized that, hey, wait a minute, you know, I don't have to put the full report in my UFO traffic reports anymore. I can just give it a case number. If the public wants to read the whole report, there it is. But I think people like to just get the sort of the quick overview. Give me one paragraph,
yeah.
what happened at this site. So I can
right.
choose. Do I want to read any more, or I'm
yeah.
going to go on? You know,
right.
But what's missing?
Well, cool.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but let me say one last thing. What's missing right now is more of what you just suggested. We need more work on what's happening, where are the hot spots, where is this stuff happening?
Yeah. Well, great. You know what? Thanks for being on the show. We are completely out of time. You know, we'll definitely have you on again. Everybody, check him out at examiner.com. Just look up you can Google UFO Examiner, and he's going to be right there at the top of the list. So thanks for being on. We are out of time. Thanks for everybody in the chat. Also, I'm going to be out at least next week, maybe even the week after, because I've got the MUFON symposium next week. I'm moving to Arizona also that week. So we'll see if I can pop in a show. But do not worry, ladies and gentlemen. I will be back, and we'll definitely have Roger on again sometime in the future. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roger. And everybody else, you guys have.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And everybody have a lovely remainder of your weekend.